Hi, Radicals, and thanks for tuning in. This is Sam here from the Radical Writing Podcast. Some of these texts stretch content as experimentally as they do form, and this is a heads up that some episodes feature discussions of a particularly sensitive nature. For example, we may be reading and then elaborating on extracts which feature swearing, violence, and sexual content. And discussions will be compassionate and empathetic, but also, in order to accurately reflect the text, explicit. Engaging with these challenging topics is often key to the author's technique and central to the story they're telling. But they can be difficult subjects to discuss and listen to. Listen for the trigger warnings at the start of the episode, and if you prefer to avoid that episode, do check out another one from the series. And if you think that the series as a whole may not be suitable for you, that's okay too. If you are comfortable listening on, now is the time to pop your headphones on or to find a private space. Hello, Radicals, and welcome to the weird and wonderful literary world of the Radical Writing Podcast, the series dedicated to the best in contemporary experimental or innovative writing. This is episode 3, Harriet Tarlow's The Ground Aslant. My name is Sam Kemp, and I'll be your host. I'm a poet and lecturer in creative writing. Today, my guests are Emile Mohanan and Kate Gradouin, and we've all chosen a favourite poem and prepared some questions for the group. The Ground Aslant, an anthology of radical landscape poetry, is edited by Harriet Tarlow and was published by Shearsman in 2011. It features poetry by some of the UK's most prominent landscape poets, such as Peter Riley, Zoe Scolding, and Francis Presley, as well as Tarlow herself, who also introduces the volume with an informative and inspiring essay which covers the traditions and themes of the developing radical landscape poetry genre. This is the only text in the Radical Writing Podcast series to have radical in the name. And as Tarlow explains, the genre reaches for a broad but definite aim of radicality in terms of form, language, and subject. Play in both how the poem appears on the page and in what it explores is key to approaching the work, and the genre is purposely difficult to pin down. The poetry moves beyond the rose-tinted pastoral, but recognises its enduring presence in the fields and lanes of Britain, and touches on the politics of eco-poetry without being subsumed into it. As Tarlow writes, the territory of these poems lie betwixt and between, both in terms of their engagement with and positioning between the pastoral and eco-poetic genres, and in the innovative linguistic games they play with sound, sense, and form, and, ultimately, language's slippery relationship with place. Okay, Kate, I'll let you introduce yourself.
Thank you, Sam. My name is Kate Grandjean, and I'm an associate professor in art history. And I love this invitation to come and participate. I work on landscape and think about landscape through the prism of painting. And a lot of people have talked about how paintings are poems of landscapes. And so I found, we'll talk about it, but it was very, very interesting.
And Emile.
Hi, my name is Emile Mohanan. I'm an assistant professor in data science. Like Kate said, I really enjoyed reading the book. It's nice because I have a background as a geographer, and it was nice to see where geography kind of got some of its influences in rethinking landscape over the last few years. So yeah, it was nice to engage with some literature.
Yeah, Emile, Kate, thank you so much for coming in. And Kate, I remember before this podcast was a thing, a few years ago, sort of bumping into you in the corridors and talking about landscape and art and poetry and thinking about this text at this time. So yeah, it's wonderful to kind of have an opportunity to talk to you properly about it. So shall I jump in with my favourite poem to sort of kick us off? It is Zoe Scolding's The New Bridge on page 131. I should say that picking a favourite poem is quite a difficult thing. So a favourite might be kind of difficult to define, but I'm going to read out the poem. It's not too long, so I can kind of read out all of it. This is on
page 131,
The New Bridge by Zoe Scolding. As the vein runs under fragile reconstructions of what was holding us together, the river made of time and water, I walk beside the swing of your pulse and your heart pumps in both directions at once. The lines of the landscape run through me to somewhere else. Sight lines shriek into the present. Loyalties tattooed in rose and gold stop my mouth for We are water and time runs through us. The river sings between, but between rose and gold and blood runs between us, outlines of fish in the shadows slipping green. On this side of the river, we, and on that side, they. So, yeah, I really love this piece because of the language, because of this kind of jump from one line to the next. There's no kind of, well, there is a narrative here, but it's one that occurs in kind of the shifting of spaces down the page. And visually as well, you can't quite see it on the audio, of course, but visually the poem does shift down the page. We've got certain lines which are indented quite far over to the right and the center. What are your kind of impressions of this particular poem?
It's interesting, actually, looking at it on the page, it flows like a river, doesn't it?
Yeah.
The different lines are arranged from left to right, as you say. To me, it's a good example of one of the uses of poetry in this volume, which is the way in which the self merges with the landscape and becomes, there's a sort of the boundary between the poet's voice and the space, the place they're in, how they see the world around them, becomes a sort of, it dissolves and it becomes one, and their feelings sort of flow into the landscape, or the landscape flows back into them and allows them to say things about how they feel.
I think that's a beautiful summary. I think it does allow them to say things about how they feel. It's not just a kind of description of place, is it? It's always sort of this place as a mirror of people and vice versa. Yeah, you used the word flow there, which I think is really nice. There is a distinct flow between the language and the place and the person. And I think in this poem in particular, it's one which it's not concluded in a kind of very conclusive way. It's not as though we're brought right back to the beginning at the end and left with a kind of tidy message to take away with. And it seems kind of representative of a lot of the poems in the collection. A shift, it's a fort, it's a start of something. And I guess you're kind of encouraged to then take it on and think what it could be. Emil, what do you think?
I was wondering what you liked about it, actually.
Yeah, sure. I probably didn't explain it very well. The language, for a start, I think as Kate kind of highlighted, that mix between place and person comes into that language and into that sense of rhythm. It flows so nicely to read, and it's quite a pleasure to read out loud. I think I liked it that it refused that conclusion, refused that kind of ending. But it does end with, in the shadows slipping green, on this side of the river we, and on that side they. And that kind of made me think of time. I don't know if I'm quite reading it
actually properly. I had that thought, because in the introduction they talk about, like, you experience the landscape through movement. And, like, I was reading this again, and it's just like there's lots of movement in there. It's like runs through us and runs between us. Yeah. It's like on this side, on that side. That's what really stood out to me, this idea of movement. And it looks like it's flowing, like you said. The poem itself looks like it's moving.
Yeah. Is it a movement between a them and us? Because I was kind of struck by the last line, partly because I don't know if I've understood it. And for me, it made me think of time, old and new, a peopled landscape that's kind of had this connection with people for maybe many years, just as a new bridge won't have had connection with wherever it is situated for as long. So I kind of took the, on this side of the river we, and on that side they, to be referring to kind of us in the present time, and a they as more generations past or distant past. But even as I say that, there's not a huge amount in the poem that speaks to that. I kind of just found it here.
I love that the river sings. The river sings, loyalty lines shriek, vein runs. Yeah, a whole bunch of words, aren't they, that go to what you're saying, Emil, movement and flowing. I must say, I'd missed it the first time around. I thought it, and reading it again is, it's interesting.
I feel as if that's the story of so many of these poems, is that they only kind of come alive on a second, third or fourth sort of reading, and then the little segments of language, because I always love the lyrical stuff, the real kind of heavy images. I always kind of, I'm really instantly seduced by anything like that. But it also feels, there is something underneath it as well. And is that kind of grander message, which I think you kind of highlighted earlier, which is that connection between the self and place and language.
Yeah. But I think also the other difficulty is that a lot of this poetry you have to read out loud, even when you're by yourself, because it is about rhythms, isn't it? And spacing, about lines that stop and start, gaps, because so many of the poets here want to sort of, they want you to understand something about landscape through words and through sounds. And so I think that it's quite demanding. I found it quite demanding poetry, I must say.
Yeah.
I thought, right, Sam, I must do my work and keep coming back to it. It was always on the bottom of the pile of books. But as we were saying earlier, I really enjoyed it because it was a struggle at times to get through some of the poems.
Yeah.
And but that struggle returns, it gives you back something.
Yes.
A sort of sensitivity to language and what language can do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think that's a nice way of putting it as well. It is a sensitivity to language. And that just as it's a sensitivity to place as well, I kind of feel as though some of the locations that are described here, I feel like I visited them. Mm. I feel like I can see them or imagine them, even though they're not described in a line-by-line, detail-by-detail kind of image. They're described in much more of a kind of feeling or tone or something more ephemeral, but I feel as though I can see the new bridge.
Completely. Well, because you walk, the poem propels you through a landscape. It takes you from a hill to the horizon or from the top of the hill down to the valley. Mm. So your eye is roving, moving around the landscape thanks to the words and the ways in which the poetry guides, the poem guides your sight within a within a particular landscape, doesn't it?
I also think I already, we're kind of talking about one of my main points and maybe getting onto one of my questions as well, so I'll avoid that, but the relationship between landscape and the page seems to be kind of central concern to so many of these poems. Just as you were sort of saying, Kate, we shift our eyes through the poem and we shift our sense of voice or of place or time. And it feels like it's exactly the same thing as walking through a moorland or through a rural area. Emil, do you want to come in with your favourite poem at this point?
Yeah, so the one I picked out is by Wendy Mulford, and it's The Salt House, 1099. It's on page 54. Shall I explain why I picked the poem?
If you could
read it first and then explain.
Sort of some of it. Yeah, I know this one. I mean, if you're happy to read out the whole thing, I'd say go for that, yeah.
I'll read it out. It's Salt House, 1099-1953. At Martinmas, the incoming tide rushed up so strongly that none remembered the like before. A lot of red-breasted flycatchers, Ik bin Brahms, Dr. Joanne Brahms. The high clear pane windows transmit light from north to south, from west to east. Shut the doors or the sound will die. Under the plain timber roofs, no glories. Of angels, no chancel mysteries. Wood stone tiles for your seafaring people. The sea washes through like light. The cost of protection would be out of proportion to the value of the limited land area protected. By the time the sea bank goes, the worst will be over. Approximately 40% of the houses are empty much of the year. It would be cheaper to buy up all the properties at risk than to spend £500,000 on sea defences. Hedges tall and plump with berries. Hips slows, elders slide off. Drop in delayed harvest. Sea lavender faded, heather grows. Burning slow crab bodies track the marsh worn. Warm worm coils tile the pool oyster catchers scratch the air. Beyond palings, beyond bridges, where settlement and sea contend.
Yeah, lovely.
I like this because it was discussed in the introduction, and it talked about like the break in the middle of the poem where there's almost like a news report, and it said that the first part is a kind of visitor's eye of being in a landscape that's pointing out these things as someone looking at it from the outside. And the second part is someone who's on the inside talking about the things that they feel, and they're like two differences. And I found that really nice. And like you said, it's just like who gets to speak about a landscape. Like I think that was the question it raised that I really liked. And just like the different things that you notice in the first and second parts of the poem, or the things that are kind of pointed out.
Yeah, no, I'm really glad that you mentioned this piece, and it's, I was going to say fun, because I don't know if fun is the right word, but the just the use of tone and that juxtaposition.
A break in the middle.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, wood stone tiles for your seafaring people. The sea washes through like light. Cost of protection will be out of proportion to the value of the limited land area protected. This real kind of official legal language that's mixed in with these lovely sound-based lyricism. What do you think, Kate?
What really interests me here is how my ideas of what a poem are so conservative. I think of a poem as being a set of lines or verses, and with a sort of regularity and a pattern and a rhythm. And what I find so interesting here is this, and I'm thinking, well, is this what radical means here? And that as you know, Emile draws attention, and also as you read it, you can hear these different types of voices, different types of language, and they're all folded together in one poem to talk about something really important for all of us, about the use of land and its transformation. Is that right? And so, yeah, so this is a poem, thinking about it now, that really helps me understand how far poetry has travelled, maybe, and or how I must think differently about a poem.
I think you're right to kind of highlight that it's not the usual tone. It's not the usual poem. I guess we come back to the title of the collection, Radical Landscape Poetry. It's designed to be quite left field compared to everything else. But yeah, I really love this piece, and it's just such a kind of fun experiment in juxtaposition, but with a serious message underneath as well, of coastal erosion and sea life and human life. Yeah. Kate, do you want to jump in with your favourite poem?
So actually following on the conservative line of poetry within the radical landscape. I'm going to choose on page 30, Peter Riley's Prelude. And this is a very short poem in the book where lots of the poems go to several pages. Mm. It's just 11 lines. So Prelude. Snow has settled in the lines of an old ridge and furrow system, striping the gently sloping dark green fields, engrossed script of duration, repetition, authority, at which that calm baby in the self that finds it so difficult to speak lowers an eyelid on the shrinking day and suddenly says outright, the entire brochure of love and all, stay here before you fall. So I think it's very, I'm not very good at reading poetry, and I recommend everybody to read it for themselves, and it's really beautiful.
I think you read it brilliantly.
And so what do I love about this? What I love about the poem is that it gives me a real image of a place in my mind. I can see the snow settling in the lines of a ridge and furrow system in the fields, and striping in the gently sloping dark. I can really feel here somebody walking in the countryside at night. And this second sense then is how walking in this landscape stimulates thought. And this is something that's very personal. I walk a lot, and when I'm walking in a landscape, it helps to calm me down, or it helps me to think about what I have to do. And this is why I love the way this comes to the end, where it says, you know, that sort of sense of the this voice inside that finds it so difficult to speak will hear in this landscape. You suddenly think, yes, I can say this. The entire brochure of Love and All, I'm going to be able to say it. I'll go back and say it. And that, I thought, was, if that's the, that's the way I understood it anyway, and I thought it was beautiful. So this sort of sense of, again, as we were saying earlier, you're penetrated by landscape. You're at one with the landscape. But the landscape, it sort of, it helps us think, actually. And walking in a landscape helps us think.
Yeah, I think it is beautiful. I think this, and I mentioned to you earlier, this was my second choice for a radical poem. And yeah, there's something just incredibly calming about the image, but it's done sort of self-consciously, I guess. Like it's not indulging in the pastoral, I think. I think it's touching on the pastoral and these classic images, but it's not kind of, there's something about it that still has a foot out, that it's sort of not trying to pretend it's the pastoral isn't something that's going to be perfect. But yeah, it definitely made me think of when you do pass those old ridge and furrow systems, where if you've seen these in the fields, because some of them can be grade sort of 2 or grade 1 protected as well, where you have the old kind of bumps coming up, and there's something, this instant tangible connection to ploughing and the past and the bringing up of soil and food and cultivation, that's just instantly very grounding, literally, I suppose, and figuratively grounding. Yeah. Emil, sorry.
I was going to ask if this was an example of the pastoral, but I think you kind of touched on it a bit.
Yeah, I think, I suppose it's, I think it is more pastoral than some of the other poems.
Yeah.
It's closer to the land than some of the other poems. But there still seems to be that little bit of distance.
Yeah, I think especially that word authority in there, right? It's just of duration, repetition, authority.
Yeah. I like that idea of reading the ground as well, that the green fields engrossed script of duration, repetition, authority. And just sort of going back to what you were saying earlier, Kate, yeah.
That's definitely an idea in geography, this idea of like green field, like engrossed as a kind of making of that space and how power and authority is represented over nature in that space.
Of the hedgerows and the kind of compartmentalizing of land. Yeah, really, really beautiful piece. So I'm going to kind of move us on to questions, but I feel as though we could dive into some of these poems more. But yeah, I think maybe let's move on to some questions. Emil, do you want to go first?
Yeah, I guess my first question was, the book is called The Ground Aslant, and I just wondered what is meant by aslant here. Is it like, is it the radical bit where you're rethinking the ground? I don't know. Yeah, I would like to explore that question, or just that word.
Kate, what do you think?
So, yes, I agree. I wasn't sure what it meant, whether it was sideways. A slant seems to me a sideways. So is it looking at the landscape from a sideways perspective or not? Is it about looking?
I guess it does seem to imply a perspective, doesn't it?
Yeah.
A
slant. Is it the ground aslant?
So the ground, like, looked at it from a different angle, maybe?
Do you think that's what it is? It's also used in one of the poems, so I wondered, is it a quote from one of the poems that's extrapolated and used?
It's in, actually, The Ground Aslant. No, that's talking about the term radical landscape poetry itself.
I think it does come back to that term, though, right? I think it is all kind of embedded in what is radical about this and what is radical about the landscape.
She also talks about Emily Dickinson, one of the early innovators of telling it slant, which is... which is in the name of your course.
It's one of the names of the courses here at Northeastern University London. Yeah, I think I took it to be, it's such a simple, deceptively simple word and verb or well, yeah, I suppose a verb to make something, a slant. But it seemed to, yeah, I think like you said, it seemed to capture the perspective, capture the vision of the landscape that a lot of these poets have. And it's a kind of real explorative vision rather than definitive. Mm. It's, I think there's a lovely line in the introduction which sort of says this is a poetry full of questions and uncertainty and doubt. That a slant seems to kind of introduce those questions or open those questions up. I think it's purposefully open and maybe frustratingly so as well, if you kind of describe it as, well, what's that poem like? It's quite a slant. It's like the landscape. The landscape could be a slant.
Yeah.
There's something kind of just unreal about it, I guess. But yeah, I think good question. So if I jump in with one of mine. So, Kate, you mentioned sort of walking in the landscape earlier on. If you were going to write a poem about a place or maybe create any kind of artwork or project about a place, where would it be and why?
Oh, gosh, Sam, that's such a difficult question. If I had to write a poem about a place, I think it would have to be about Greenwich Park. I live near Greenwich, and I walk down through the park and to the river and back up. And it's a sort of wonderful park if you don't know it. It's a place that's full of, has been used as palaces. It was a royal park. It's also a place where you do astronomy because but above all, it's that sense of London being connected to the river. Mm. And I know it through all the seasons, and early in the morning and late at night, and summer and winter. And I suppose I have a very peripatetic life between different places, but I always feel very grounded when I'm walking in Greenwich Park. I'm not sure I'd be able to do it because I'm useless at writing, but that would be the aim, to write a poem.
I think you've got a pretty good grounding because it feels as though that relationship with place is exactly what is the basis. So many of these poems are kind of obsession or familiarity. Place as character, almost. And you kind of mentioned knowing it in summer, autumn, spring and winter. Yeah, it feels like that sense of wholeness.
It's, there's sort of landscapes you know through the seasons, but then you sort of, but I think the thing about writing a poem about a place is that you then get to know that place in a very different way, don't you? Because you have to go and look and think and choose and select.
Emil, what about you?
I'm glad you didn't ask me this question first. I'm thinking about it. I used to have this conversation with a friend of mine about landscape, and he'd say, landscape isn't the countryside.
That's true.
And when you ask this question, I feel like, oh, you want to write something about a landscape, it's got to be in nature somehow. It can't be anywhere else. But I have picked a place that is nature because that's the place that I thought of, which is like in the woods where I go to train, where I do sports outside. Like Kate said, I spend a lot of time there outside. And I know the trees, and I know, like, the hills, and, like, yeah, I just know the landscape there a lot, and I know it through the seasons. And I feel like it's the woods, Shirley Hills in Croydon. It's where I train. It's, like, last remaining sort of forest area in the edges of London.
I love this pattern that, we see a place in all of its seasons and all of its times. Mm. And conditions, and yet we can never know it fully. We can never actually fully know the place, but we can at least feel some comfort and familiarity from it. There's a sort of magic as to just how big the world is.
I think it's one of those things that, like, this idea of movement, right? Like, through the seasons, like, things change. And I think when you experience that change is when you actually interact with a landscape. I think it feels like it's that way. And when you just see something once, it's just the picture.
That's a nice thing to highlight as well, that none of the poems are static. Yeah, I know we sort of said this earlier, none of the poems are a picture, are a solid picture. Even the new bridge it's not really about the bridge. It's about all these bits and pieces beside it and around it and us and the water and the flow and all these kind of particles, which presumably make up the stone of the bridge, is all these other things as well. Yeah, I think that's a lovely phrase. Kind of, it's not a static picture, and none of them are. Yeah, I think for me, I should have thought of this, shouldn't I? If I was asking the question, but I think probably the North Devon coast. There's a place called Heartland Quay where they do quite a lot of filming because it's incredibly dramatic and beautiful, and you've got these jagged, sharp lines of rock. You as a geographer would be able to tell me more about it, probably Emil, or at least some of the kind of social life around there as well. But yeah, these sharp, jagged bits of rock that just go right out into the Atlantic, and these huge waves that come in. It's a proper kind of smuggler's cove. But the I think I remember just always being really struck by the kind of violence of the waves. They come in with such ferocity on the rocks, and the rocks take it and break apart and roll over and come back and end up breaking the waves in some way. Yeah, it's really kind of dramatic and stunning. Yeah. I don't know what I'd say about it because it's difficult to write about a place like
that.
You've
given us a good idea. Yeah.
Kate, do you want to jump in with one of your questions?
Well, actually, when you said have a question, I was thinking about a question about the collection itself. Maybe that's not the sort of question you want, because I wondered what you felt in an anthology, and there's 16 writers here, I've just counted them, about the use of selected verses. Because it seems to me with a poem, it's really something quite specific in its form. It's a beginning, a middle, and an end, but it's really tightly constructed, whether it's over several pages or whether it's just like 11 lines. And I was a little bit bothered by the sort of idea of this the extracts from a poem that you get verse 1 or 3 or 5, or you just get, because you want to know, well, hang on, why these and why not the rest? Or, and I just wondered whether that had bothered you, because I would have liked a little bit more information from the editor as to why include it if you're not going to include it completely, or if you're just going to use these verses, then why these, you know, what does it say?
What do you think, Emil? Throwing all the difficult questions over to you.
No, I mean, I had a similar thought too. I was just like, oh, we don't get to see the rest of it seems.
Yeah.
But I don't know if that's an acceptable practice in poetry, actually. That I kind of rationalised it to myself. I said, oh, maybe that's the convention in poetry, that you can just take an extract of, like, many images. And
I feel like it's maybe not the convention to have that many excerpts from longer sequences in one anthology. But then I feel as though it's representative of landscape poetry in general, which does seem to be written in sequences and have this beginning and middle and end, but one that stretched over 100 pages or 50 pages or so. So it feels like it's maybe the best way of representing the breadth of radical landscape poetry. But I agree. I think in an anthology, it's tricky.
It's more like a video. It's like you can have bits collected from like other videos and they're just brought together, and it's like all together it shows something rather than, I don't know, you don't need the whole, like,
it's true.
Yeah.
It forms, I mean, the anthology itself, yeah, forms a kind of mismatch of landscapes, which you could say is one landscape in itself, somehow representative or attempting to be representative of the idea of landscape poetry in Britain. But yeah, no, that struck me as well. Yeah.
It did.
Yeah, and I think I kind of had to go back and seek the originals, which is what Tarlo kind of mentioned in the introduction. And it worked for me in that I did end up ordering more books when I started reading this anthology. But I think it's a really good question, because I think it comes back to that idea of sequence.
I think in the introduction she does talk about go and read the other one.
Yeah, yeah, and it worked for me.
So she really wanted to build us an idea of how it's changing over time, because they're arranged, are they arranged chronologically?
Yes, yeah.
By date as well?
Yeah. I think it's by time.
Right.
But it's also just that so many of the most kind of famous or the best radical landscape poetry is in sequence. It's written in these longer, more kind of obsessive, immersive sequences, which do go on for much longer than an average poem.
Really, that's so interesting.
So that's why I guess it's, you can only take out the bits, because the other thing, because the other landscape poetry book that I've seen was also just like a long book with lots of photographs and bits of text.
Yeah, they write long poems, landscape poets, and I suppose there's a reason.
Landscape
for that.
Is huge.
Landscape is huge and changing and shifting, and it also, I think, as a writer, it enables you to maintain different spaces of voice and narrative and tone and sound and do all these wonderful things. But also from a much more basic point of view, I wonder if landscape poets need that length in order to feel as though they're getting somewhere with the subject and feel as though they're kind of getting into a depth for the subject. It doesn't seem possible to write a shorter poem about some of these places. Yeah.
So I'm guessing you're capturing like multiple parts of a scene, right? It's not like it's not a single photograph. I'm thinking of David Hockney. You know, where he has lots of photographs from different angles of like the same thing. I don't know if you've seen his pictures. And it seems to be like that kind of way of capturing a landscape as a poem. It seems to be lots of poems like capturing bits of a landscape.
Yeah, I'd say so. I think that's maybe a lovely note to end our discussion as well. This kind of idea that it's like a multiplicity of image.
Yeah.
And all of them are maybe a slant. Or maybe all of them are not a slant, but when they come together, they're a slant. So, The Ground Aslant is easy to find via the Shearsman website or through your local bookshop or library. Currently, the first 20 pages are also available as a PDF online. Kate and Emil, thank you so, so much for joining me. I can now present you with your official Radical Writer flag. Nice, so congratulations.
Oh, wow. That's wonderful. Thank you so much, Sam. It's been amazing. Wonderful.
Thank you for coming on. You have been listening to the Radical Writing Podcast. Huge thank you to my guests, Emil Mohanan and Kate Grajuan. And equally huge thanks you to our production team, Alistair Robinson, Mark Dutton and Rob Adey. Join us next time for episode 4, where we'll be discussing Tom Phillips' A Humourment. And as always, stay radical.